Thanks for being here. So as Chongor mentioned, we'll be discussing the Volibit story, how it turned out to be a great success, how it got funding after 15 years into operations, and then Balaj's transition into becoming a boring angel investor and then a fun entrepreneur again. But to start it off, can you please tell us a bit about Volibit, just to set the context right?
Yes. Volibit basically was a startup before startups were a thing. And then we eventually grew into being a startup, so to say. As this was my first job ever in 2000 after graduating from university. So back then, venture was about investing into agricultural companies and not high-tech startups. So
because high-tech meant putting software in a box. Wasn't that high.
Yeah, that's right.
These boxes.
Yeah, these boxes. That was in 21, and our very first product, like 2 years into the business, and yeah, we did that because everyone else did that too. And again, I mean, just to explain the funny pictures and somewhat. Anyway. So the left side is our cloud, which is basically a shovel port. You know that term, and our test system sitting on top, which were like, you know, we need a couple of computers, so we put them there. And I don't know if everyone has actually used a CRT monitor, but we had a few of those as well. We didn't have that screen back then. And the right-hand side is interesting because...
This one better? Ah, okay. So this is easier. So on the right-hand side, so there was one task everyone was assigned when they joined the company, which you can clearly see on the right-hand side. So they had to assemble their own desk. That was the very first task. And this was becoming more and more complicated as we, you know, hired more people. So eventually this pulled after a point.
What happens if you can't? No desk?
It wasn't an option.
Okay. And can you tell us a bit about like what Volibit does? From a business perspective and the technology-wise?
Sorry. Yeah, so like I said, we grew into being a startup, but we did a lot of mistakes. If we consider it from being a startup perspective, we had multiple products, an eternal mistake for all the startups out there. At first, we had a firewall product. So we created an enterprise firewall for... One thing that happened in Volibit, and which I didn't want to repeat in any way, is that we burned through a number of ideas and product concepts until we got to where, you know, we could scale a business. So basically, we learned our way from being a university graduate into being a startup and finding our niche where we produce value. And so firewalls, then we had... privileged access management. Privileged access management is about the sysadmins trying to do stuff on, you know, systems they operate. And there are certain risks associated with privileged access, and we were trying to mitigate those. And the third thing we did was, or has been, a log management product, which has some ties into the news story. But so there were basically these three things that made up Volibit. Over the years, we pivoted several times and, you know, just trying to work through what the market opportunity were.
But you guys weren't venture funded for like 15 years. You got your first venture funding in 2015. So although you were trying to find product market fit, sell a product, etc., you were generating revenue and keeping afloat at the same time, right?
Yeah, my favorite KPI we had back then.
Cash flow.
So, and Zoli is back, and because he was managing and looking at this KPI, is we called it, how many months do we have still before we get bankrupted?
And you never want to have 24 months. You never want to have 6 months, right? Somewhere in between.
I think we touched the 3 month mark more than once. So obviously we had some lows and highs in the story, but yeah. So. We basically made some revenue and we reinvested it all. We never get any dividends or those kind of funds. So for 15 years, I mean, we started from 20K as a capital. And yeah, by 2014, we were roughly a 10 million euro business with 120 employees.
That's big, but when was the year you said, okay, this is getting big?
Never.
Wasn't big enough ever, right?
No, I mean, all the competitors we had back then were huge companies, much larger than we were. So while we were doing firewalls, there was Checkpoint. While we were doing privileged access management, there were CyberArk, and log management wise, there were LogRhythm, QRadar, and you know, everyone.
And you touched base a bit about the pivots. What was the last pivot? After which pivot you said, okay, this is working out, flywheel is turning, I'm gonna scale the shit out of this?
So we started, so we set out to do a global business. That was a goal from the start. As with every Hungarian company, we try to sell in Hungary first. Our very first year when we started investing into getting outside of Hungary was in 2003. So 3 years into the business when we exhibited.
It's pretty soon, no? It's early on.
Well, now the expectation is to do this 3 months into the business and not 3 years.
3 months before starting the business.
Yeah, so, and the first successful salesperson that could sell outside of founders was in 07, 08. So it took us roughly 5 years to get there. And the pivots happened, so from firewalls, and so our firewall was very unique and should have, you know, been a much greater success. It still exists.
Everyone's firewall is unique for them. We all have
true.
Unique firewalls.
But if I tell you that we had this firewall technology, and in 07 we removed 2/3 of the functionality, multiplied the price 10 times, and then we started to sell. That was the pivot I was mentioning, and that was what gave enough boost to the organization so that it could actually go outside.
And how big was the company at the time of exit in terms of number of employees and revenue?
That picture is in 15. We had a different one, but that's hanging on my wall, so I couldn't take that here.
This is the 5 million pound picture, right?
Yes, this is the 5 million pound picture. We were roughly 250, 260 people, and 35% of that was outside of Hungary. And the largest office outside of Hungary was New York, which that's not that. That's our second office, because the first one was a flat in Köztelek Street. I don't know. I don't tell you about our neighbors. But anyway, so.
What happened to them? What did you do to them? What's up with the neighbors?
You will not. This person, Sjorbert Norby, his mother was living the next floor, and I met him one time. I mean, he's a celebrity.
I was so in between football player and serial killer. I didn't know.
No. Anyway, so that was the neighbor. So this was resembling more of an office, that building with the green roof.
And after the exit, did you ever look back and said, why the fuck did we sell this? Or were you always content with the exit?
It was a good decision. 18 years is a long time. It's, you know, burning out is not a good feeling, but that's what we had back then. That was really long. So I needed to recover and to regain my energies.
And to recover, you became an angel investor and advisor. You invested into Avatao, BitNinja, there was one more, Hackrate.
A couple others.
Why was it so boring for you? Why did you decide to roll up your sleeves and become an entrepreneur again?
It's not boring, but not exciting. So interesting in a number of ways, but you are not in the saddle. So you can state your opinion, and your opinion might be considered. But it's
might
not
be heard.
Might be heard.
Let alone considered.
And so that was the reason, I think. And the other is that you need goals and objectives. And I'm a hobby investor, and it just wasn't feeling right.
I guess what's even worse is watching all the other founders have fun while you're angel investing into them. You know, if you were away from them, then you wouldn't get FOMO'd, you know? Should be a bigger FOMO to watch them have all the fun while you advise them. Whatever that means. And at Bullybit, you guys didn't do a pre-seed round, you guys didn't do a seed round, you guys did a straight up Series A in that context. Whereas with Axoflow, you raised the largest pre-seed round of the country. How did that how did the perspective of yours change over that two decades?
So I mentioned this number of different products that we burned through while failing to scale at Bullybit times. We didn't fail as an organization, but we did fail a number of ideas, basically, because we didn't fulfill them. One reason was that we were slow. And we were slow for a number of reasons, one being that we just graduated from university and never learned how to run a business. But it's also that we didn't have the resources to you know, invest into sales and marketing and that entails. The reason we acquired funding back at Bullybit, so there are a number of reasons, but one important or key element was that we did jump from country to country in Europe, and each of these countries had certain risk and certain budget requirements, and the step to the US was just too steep. So at the end, we decided to take money to fund that.
How much money did they make after investing at 2015? What was their multiple?
Can I say that? No, sorry.
It's been too long. You can, I mean. How much money would have they made?
I think there was a lot more in Bullybit than deliver on it. So the technology, the depth, the team, the culture, it should have been, you know, among the larger, even larger exits globally as well, if you just compare that. So from that sense, we could say that that wasn't much of a big deal. I mean, it was like.
And jumping onto Axoflow. So Axoflow optimizes data supply chain for observability. What does that mean? What do you guys do?
So there is all this data in organizations. So companies run off data, more and more digitalized these days. So obviously the data amounts are increasing. But there is a very important distinction between business data, you know, CRMs, you know, accounting, whatever that you use to your contracts that you run use to run the business. But there is a whole lot of other, so there's a different class of data that we call machine data or not business data that systems generate as they operate. So if you run a firewall, you will have machine data because the firewall operates. If you run an Oracle server, same happens. If you run a web server, same happens. And if you look at the amounts, then machine data is probably 10 times more than business data. Maybe the multiple is even larger. And businesses use machine data for a number of reasons. To most important one is security reasons. I want to understand if there is a security breach, and machine data is the only thing that tells me. The other motivation is usually operations. So I want to know if my system, you know, is getting slow, or there is an outage, or this. So businesses collect machine data to find if they have a security breach or if, you know, there is an operational failure somewhere, and we help them in this regard. So the observability data supply chain is basically the systems and mechanisms how enterprises collect and deliver to wherever it needs to go, either the security part of the organization or the operational parts of the organization. This is where we help. So that's roughly the box we. And our history in Bullybit is important because I happen to be the founder of an open source technology that's called SysLogNG, and that happens to be one of our products at Bullybit, which we monetize later on. This project goes back to 1998, so previous century.
How old were you back then?
I was 21. I wrote this piece of open source software, a lot of people started to use it. A lot of organizations started to use it, and big ones too. So NASA was one of my users back then. The US Army was one of my users back then. Twitter was one.
Did you say USSR?
No, oh, US.
Sorry. Okay. I thought that it existed back then.
I don't know about the others.
Then.
So anyway, I said eternal mistake when I talked about the multiple focuses at Bullybit, but we started to monetize and started to productize SysLogEngine because it was such a big success. And people started to come to us to, you know, for support, for features, for whatever. And this is how it happened. We just followed their lead.
And this observability space is very, very competitive. Even the abstraction of observability is getting more and more competitive. You guys are differentiating through focusing on log management and then your understanding of SysLogEngine because you've actually built it from scratch. Can you elaborate on that a little further as to how you would differentiate from direct competitors?
So we do have a very sizable installation base. So enterprises, most of the enterprises will have SysLogEngine somewhere in the infrastructure. We are leveraging that. SysLogEngine is, you know, the kind of tool that Unix engineers with long beards would operate, and just mocking them. So
they like it. they want it.
So there are these systems that that have been deployed, you know, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, and their management or their operation is really manual. It may happen that these people have left the organization where they deployed it. So even the talents and skill sets to retain this talent is missing. So there needs to be some kind of change how these organizations run these systems. And they have two options, you know, replace it completely or try to solve the issue. And there are obviously vendors that that tell to these organizations that, okay, here's my new shiny stuff, let's get rid of the old and replace it. And there is the other option to evolve it or to, you know, optimize it further. So we are in the second camp because enterprises tend to be risk averse, especially when we are talking about their security infrastructures and you know, their ability to feed 20 to 30 terabytes of data into their security systems every day. So we are talking about a lot of data here, and these systems have been humming in, you know, for decades, and we are making this possible for them to not replace their existing infrastructures, but rather augment or extend it and reach to the new shiny.
And you're in the process of finding lighthouse customers, design partners, initial POCs, etc. Can you define what your ideal customer persona is and how you came to that?
I mentioned security a number of times. So security is a very important element in an ICP. This means that these organizations tend to be compliant, so regulated industries, so financial institutions, telcos, government, healthcare. Those are the top verticals in that space.
All the fun stuff.
All the fun stuff. We also say that our target customer is hybrid. So have their cloud-based, cloud-native infrastructures as well as their, you know, boring Oracle servers, which they run their business on. So they have this complexity in their infrastructure that they need to handle. One competitive advantage is that we are able to handle the complexities of being hybrid. A lot of mainstream observability vendors, focus primarily on cloud-born organizations. And, you know, a bank is usually not cloud-born, except for Revolut. But so there are a lot of these organizations that have huge infrastructures that they need help with. And that's basically the...
And what's the current stage of the product? Like, what do you expect over the next, say, 3 to 6 months from a product and a POC perspective?
So we are launching a closed beta, but production level beta in September, end of September timeframe. We have a hopeful customer on that system already. We are the POC phase, but they are really responsive. Like, and he's asked me a question. I just sent the sales guy that he should confirm something, and they came back to us within like 10 minutes. So the customer is really interested. So if they come to our closed beta system by the end of the year and they are paying for it, I'm happy. So that's basically, we are not in the large numbers game. So we are B2B, but huge B2B. I mean, the other side is a huge, you know, Fortune 500, let's call it that way. And so for us, you know, a Series A level is like 8 to 10 companies.
And from a validation standpoint, I mean, as an entrepreneur, you want short feedback loops, you want to validate stuff, you want to validate the need in the market, the fact that you can get that need onto you and then serve it, willingness to pay, et cetera. What parts of it do you think are validated right now, and what parts will be validated over the next 3 to 6 months?
So we did validate that, yes, these companies do have these hybrid infrastructures, and it is a problem for them to retain or operate these systems, especially in sight with their new cloud-native infrastructure. So what happens usually is that these break up. The company, let's call this, I mean, Acme Corporation, does, you know, have been running happily in data centers with their own Oracle servers and everything. And then, you know, a funny engineer came and they said that we need to go to the cloud, and they did. So they now have a application in the cloud, completely nice microservice-based, operated like, say, DevOps and everything. And they need security and everything that comes with, you know, running an application. And what happens usually is that they start their cloud focused infrastructure for security. And now this company, Acme Corporation, has two security organizations, not necessarily that good. This we validated. So this actually happens in the wild, that they will have two separate silos, and basically the old school security team doesn't have oversight over the cloud part of the organization, and vice versa. And this is where, for example, where we want to help them by bridging this gap between the old school and the shiny.
And comparing this to yourself 20 years ago, how easier did it get to launch the company, have these validations? I mean, I feel like what you've done in the past, say, 6 months, you probably did first time around in 6 years or so.
Well, a lot easier. Things are easier now in general in the marketplace. So back then, venture was about agricultural companies. Now it's high tech.
It wasn't our fault. There were boxes.
So it's a lot easier. Having gone through the Bolabit experience means that I saw things, how to set up a Inc. in the US, you know, what shares are, share classes, 409 valuations, whatever, these boring stuff.
You know, are you charging me for this right now? Because whenever I hear these things, I get charged on an hourly basis.
No, so these are, but things like how to define and capture company values that we can communicate, how to set goals, how to set, you know, the iterative cadences of a company going forward. So these kind of things I saw happen. It was not necessarily my thing, but I was part of it. And this helps a lot.
And Banzai Cloud was a more proper venture story, meaning they raised funding and then get acquired by Cisco. So having Ferry and Shandor on board with you, what kind of different perspectives does that bring on the table? To you, also from a dynamism perspective, them being like a, they started a decade later than you did, maybe more.
So for those who don't know, the Exaflow is, the major part of Exaflow is actually coming from Banzai Cloud. Banzai Cloud was a startup in Hungary that was acquired by Cisco 2 years ago. And there is a lot of similarities between Bolabit and Banzai Cloud, and obviously a lot of differences as well, but one major similarity I would highlight is that they were an engineering organization and we were too. So back then we graduated from an engineering university and started Bolabit by finding problems that we felt were solving, and then eventually trying to find ways how this can be translated to value. Banzai Cloud is very similar, so that was founded by engineers, and they focused on a specific problem, Kubernetes, and the management of Kubernetes clusters that they wanted to solve. And eventually, this turned out to be valuable enough to be acquired by Cisco. So this is very much similar, but we are basically at least a generation there is a generation between them and me, or
at Volubit. Least a generation. Yeah. you put okay. it that way. I did
yeah,
that.
Yeah, sorry, that was fraud or something. So, a generation between them as, and myself. So, for them, cloud native, the way we build systems, Kubernetes, operators, CRDs. These kind of things come as their nature, and this was very much new to me. And even though I'm an engineer, I'm still coding, but I didn't know much about these things. So if they were not part of the game, this would have been a very different product at the end.
Don't tell me boxes.
No boxes.
And how big is the team currently, and what's the role split between the four of you?
The team at the moment is 12 people, so pretty sizable for a startup, almost 8 months into the business. And four of them are founders, so that's Ferenc, Sándor, Neil, and myself. Ferenc and Sándor are running the engineering organization, with Sándor being the CTO. Ferenc being more, you know, the supportive VP engineering slash wildcard, everything. So he's doing everything that makes the company work. Neil, our co-founder in the US, he is a salesperson. I worked with him at Volubit. He was our first employee in the US as a sales, joining us in 2015. That picture, he was probably on it. So he's sales slash marketing, and he has been selling into this market log management and observability data for the last 8 years. Myself, I am the CEO. And originally, when I was started to look around, you know, a new gig and what to do next, I was more in, you know, I would love to be a CTO again, but then I turned out to be a CEO. And I looked into myself and during the Volubit years or the Volubit story, there was one point up to one point I was the CEO, and then I became CTO in 2011, 2012. And this means that I did not fulfill that story completely. It was Zoltán's success. So there is this aspiration that I want to do it as well. So there was this person.
Looking from it miles apart, I would assume that for a second-time founder, it should be 100x easier to raise funding, which we'll come to. And then the second thing is establishing a killer team, which you did. The team is really top-notch. So can you elaborate that a little further? All these logos of like Banzai Cloud, Cisco, SysLogNG, Volubit, was it useful to Ustream hire that great talent?
Extremely, yes. Extremely true what you just said. So, I'm every day. Just now, our VP EMEA in the sales team just approached me that you know, he would love to join us because, you know, he liked the experience at Volubit, and this one repeats. So, sales engineers, salespeople. Engineers come to me pretty regularly that they are interested in what we do because they want to be part of it. And obviously, focus and priorities and funding, so this is not always easy because sometimes I have to say no. It's a lot easier this way because at the very least I can ask someone who has a good opinion and has some, you know, the trust is there. So a lot easier to acquire traction. And one last thing is that it's not just Volubit or Ustream. Our sales engineer in the US, he is a top-notch Splunk. Splunk is the leading vendor in the security incident and event management space. So their large accounts sales engineer came to me after one of my early posts, and he said that he liked our work on SysLogNG so much that if he can, he would love to be a part of it too. So it's not just Volubit or Hungary, for that matter, because I never worked together with that.
And fundraising-wise, I mean, we're talking about three generations of companies, like Volubit in 2000s, Banzai Cloud, let's say, in 2010s, and then AXOFLOW in 2020s. how did the fundraising environment change in Hungary? How did it change globally? And how did that impact you as you were starting the business?
When we started up, everyone, at least, the global climate is not necessarily that positive these days for fundraising.
I mean, compared to 2021. Compared to any other year, it's good. Pick a year, it's better.
Yeah, I wasn't running a fundraising campaign back then, but this was the thing I was told, that it is getting more and more difficult to get funding. People should start in time, have enough runway, and these kind of things were the advices that I got. But compared to this, I think we were pretty lucky. The interest in OxoFlow was pretty high, and I'm really happy about that and grateful too. For us, this was, so maybe this the negative part or the negative spiral of the global climate did not get to Hungary or CE yet, or maybe it never will. It's just
I think the hype also didn't come. I mean, the further you're away from liquidity, when the markets are hyped up, it doesn't come to you. And then when the markets are shrinking, which is what's happening in the US, it doesn't come to you either. There's like a buffer plus a lag almost, and then...
That can be very true. So, for us, this was exhausting time and a lot of work, but it was relatively easy.
And having Neil on board, I mean, you are a US-born startup, basically, because you have... Your co-founder is based there. He's leading sales. Your initial design partners are going to be from the US. So it's not like you're going to try to Americanize the company further on. You were born as a US-based startup. Does that feel any different? Or what are some of the measures from a culture perspective you have to take so that the company is properly Americanized?
I don't know yet.
Oh, you told me about the Slack bot, the translator.
Yeah. Okay. I get what you mean. Back in the Bolavit days, we were pushing the entire organization to talk, for example, English. So the primary language should be in English, and comments in code, those should be in English, of course. But from time to time, it still happens that we talk in Hungarian, for example, in our Slack channels, and we have US-based colleagues. So this is a habit that we need to get into. But it would be much more difficult to push to this international culture if we didn't have colleagues. So we do have this conscience that they, if we fall back to using Hungarian, they will tell, they will say the word that we should not, or they just ask for a translation bot for the.
And what's next for AxoFlow? So over the next 12, 18 months, what should we expect from a number of customers perspective, number of employees, next round of fundraising?
So if everything goes well, then we should start fundraising in the middle of next year or so. So that obviously ties into the traction that we can generate by that. I told you that a Series A level would be like 8 to 10 customers, and we would love to get to that point next year. We are a bit early to say, so we have lots of work to do till that happens. But that's the ballpark where we want to get.
And 6 to 8 customers, how does that correlate to ARR and then maybe potential ARR with all the upsell opportunities?
Yeah, our target deal size is 130K per year, so roughly 10K per month. We are talking about enterprises, so that's what translates to this 1 million ARR that the Series A levels usually entail. With the current round of funding, we would love to get to a mature seed, early A, that ballpark.
Well, thanks a lot. Let's open the floor for questions in case people have questions around SysLogNG, observability, Splunk, Banzai Clouds, Kubernetes. You use some acronyms that I didn't understand, like you said CRD or some shit like that. So I don't.
We understood now why Anison 500 invested. Can you walk us through a little bit about the fundraising process and tell us how did you manage that high inbound interest, and why did you end up choosing 500 Credo and Ocean?
Okay, so so I was amazed by the interest that we encountered, and that's probably a luxury issue, and it's probably difficult to replicate, and that comes with the territory, or that I'm being a second time founder. And it's so I was my very first attempt at raising capital was going to the, you know, the trusted people, the people I knew, and this was not necessarily the right strategy because I boxed myself into situations or, you know, with specific people, and it was difficult to say no to them. And I remember Ferry and Chandor, they told me, just say no, don't care. Anyway, and then it was you, Chongor, that I met the first. So and you were so much full of energy and told me a number of options that, you know, that's when I decided that we do an angel round first and then separate institutional money. So that's what we did. We basically closed two rounds recently. The first was an angel round where we had 100k tickets, and we said that we want 300 to 500k, so 3 to 5 investors, and then we would go for, you know, a larger investment, and you know, backed with an institutional. And the reason we wanted to do the angel round is that all of our angels are there to help us and contribute in one way or another. One of our angels is Zoltan, my ex-CEO, and you know, my founding partner at Bolabit, and I hope he would help me when I have, you know, issues with building sales teams or reporting or whatever. And I've worked with him, you know, for 18 years at least at Bolabit. But we also have, you know, my ex-CFO there, who knows how to create transfer pricing, or I don't know, you know, these boring things that that the founder is facing whenever he's running a global organization without the staff. So that was the reason why we separated these two, that I wanted people that I trust and who can help me in one way or another, and in exchange for you know, in exchange for their trust in us, we tried to offer them a some discount, so they got better terms. And at the end, it wasn't very easy because we received more offers than that we wanted to raise as a part of the angel round. So this became also a very complicated decision because we had to say no. And it's yeah. Anyway, that's what we did. At the end, we decided to only take 4 tickets. So we decreased the size, and with that started the VC bagged round, and it wasn't. It's my first time doing it, so I don't think that we were very professional about that. So what happened is that I talked to someone who introduced me 3 other someones, and then 3 other someones, and eventually I had too many meetings, and
I was in connection.
So, it wasn't a very easy decision either because there were multiple solutions to this round as well. I really liked, so Anis, we met, and I really liked the relationship. We met a couple of times, we talked a lot, so that was important. I also met other VCs that I would have liked to have on board. It's just, after a while, it's a question of numbers and math. You can fit only, so not everyone fits to the table, or I don't know what is here. So that was a difficult decision. I would have liked one or more, at least one more guy on the table.
How long did it take for you guys to make an offer? And it's
it's priced. So one reason why we delayed the deal somewhat because we flipped to the US. So we initially incorporated as a Hungarian limited by shares corporation, a exercise I would not recommend to anyone. Then since one of our angel investors is a US citizen, we needed to flip into the US before the angel round. So instead of doing one round, we did two plus a flip. The angel round was a safe because we were in the US by then, and we could do a safe-based round easily. That's insanely easy. So a safe-based round, you don't have to organize a round. You just go to anyone, sign a piece of paper, the two of you, and it's done. And transfer the money. Okay. So easy. But so safes and then a prize round. And it's, sorry, 500 Emerging Europe and Credo and Notion.
Any more questions?
Can you hear me? I really like the part when you mentioned that every new colleague needed to set up their own table. What would you say, like, how did you, like, nurture slash adapt the company culture? So what would you say as, I guess, blockers, as the starter group, let's say?
It's a difficult question because we were not very conscious about this. Not conscious enough, I would say. So I think it was like 2010-ish, so 10 years into the business when we started to, you know, draft values. I don't know, Zoli, when was that? It just happened. We were proud when colleagues have, so we had these t-shirts and beer mugs, you know, the anniversary, we gave out on anniversaries, and we had a few that had 15 on it. So we had colleagues that worked over 15 years for. We had colleagues who went to another company, worked there a couple of years and came back. And these were the things we were really proud of. And I think that's the backbone why we didn't really need to work on culture, because the core of the people remained the same. But yeah, obviously, after a point, we did that, and it was really helpful to be conscious about it. And assembling a desk wasn't part of it at the end, but we still, you know, remember it is a good story. So. We became conscious about it, and I feel important about it. And we already had this brainstorming session with the Nexoflow how to draft our company values.
Why did you say that you would not recommend to organize a Hungarian entity as your vehicle?
Just one word, Keller.
It's not that hard. I remember when we discussed this, and we came to the idea that you should go ahead with the US company, but it's still okay.
I mean, it's just limited by shares. Even if it's not a publicly traded company, there are a lot of processes and procedures that are very similar to that. Yes, there are solutions to everything. And honestly, I think it did help us. So I simplified. Compared to the safes, that's complex. So we have our founding team is, I mentioned the four founders, but the founding engineers that we also have on board had the ability to subscribe to some of the shares of the company at incorporation. So our actual shareholder group is much larger than four people. That's 13, or has been 13 when we were incorporating. Having the limited by shares company allowed us to create this structure in a transparent way. So we didn't have these, you know, gentlemen's agreements on whom will get how many shares, and you know, these dodgy Excel sheets where you try to note everything. So all of our transactions and how shares got to everyone involved has been a transparent process and has been legally, you know, correct. And that wouldn't have been possible without the limited by shares company in the beginning. It's just we flipped to the US in April, so it just lived 4 months, basically. We could have done the same way in the US in the first. It just costs money, and more money, obviously, than.
Any other questions?
Yeah, so my question would be, what were your biggest takeaways that helped you build up every company after your first one? So what were the biggest efforts that spared you time later, or what were the biggest takeaways?
I mean, you mean that what is the the biggest learning I had at Bolavit that helps me.
Yeah, or which brought you the most progress or spared you the most time eventually later on.
The combination of knowledge. So I couldn't name just one thing. It's just having seen it or done it there. I couldn't just.
Right.
Sorry.
Okay. Hi. So given that you're probably going to have to do direct sales to get your first customers, those 8-10 that you mentioned, and that you're doing enterprise sales, what's your strategy for getting those first 8-10 customers? Is it going to be through connections that you've already built throughout the IT security industry, or do you actually have to go in cold to acquire those first customers?
I mean, not cold, but yes. So I mentioned Neil. He was my colleague at Bolavit joining there in 2015. So he has been in this space for 8 years or so. He has been selling these kind of solutions that we want to replace. So that's one port. So going cold is, that's probably the reason why the new tools, like observability tools, mainstream observability tools you know, don't have this legacy and address the cloud-borne organizations are architected this way. It's much easier to sell to the CTO and much easier to sell to developers than to security people in these organizations. So direct and via the help of Neil and with existing connections.
Thank you. Just a follow-up question to that. I have some experience for selling to developers, and I wouldn't say it's easy. So what would be, in like one sentence, the key difference between selling to engineers in your experience versus IT security professionals?
I think especially the latest generation of engineers are pretty open to new stuff. Security people are not so open to new stuff. CTOs too, so.
Thank you so much. Unless there are no more questions, I suggest to keep it for the break. We have some pizzas and beers and rosé fruch. Thank you so much, gentlemen. That was a great...
To stay in the loop, go to our website, getcc.com, or follow us at getcc on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and YouTube.